This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Partner Hero. Partner Hero provides customer service outsourcing that's built for the needs of scaling and high-growth startups. They offer flexible terms, fast onboarding, and the ability to scale teams quickly, which is great for fast-growing businesses. Now, in the past, outsourcing has had a bad reputation for being exploitative or somewhat, low quality. But Partner Hero's values-based approach really raises the bar. They pay above-market salaries. They have a focus on quality and performance. And unlike most business process outsourcing companies, their management team includes individuals from the startup world. So they're more than just a service provider. They're a thought partner for the startups that they serve. They've got flexible terms. They've got offices around the world. So they have truly global coverage, including onshore, nearshore, and offshore options. Now, outsourcing has long been available to many big enterprises, but Partner Hero is challenging businesses as usual with short, flexible contracts and fast ramp-up times. If you're ready to bring in outside customer support help for your startup that feels like it's a part of your existing team, check out Partner Hero. Head on over to partnerhero.com/Hansel Minutes to book a free consultation with their solutions team. Mention that you heard about Partner Hero from Hansel Minutes and they'll waive the setup fee. That's partnerhero.com/Hansel Minutes. Hi, I'm Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm chatting with Dr. Brandeis Marshall. She's an education activist, a scholar, and a data justice advocate, and currently the CEO of Data at X. I've actually got her new book, Data Conscience, Algorithmic Siege on Our Humanity, in my hand. Thank you so much, Dr. Marshall, for hanging out with me today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Scott. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, so I've got your new book, Data Conscience. It's out right now. And you actually have a foreword from Timnit Gebru, who folks may recognize that name. That's a quite a get. Do you all roll in the same space? Like, is this something?
Well, I think I roll in the same space as Dr. Timnit. She is happened to be someone that I engaged with on the Bird app, and we've just become, Bird app friends that then became engaged in just back and forth tweets and DMs and then text. And so it was very awesome for her to do the forward for the book.
That's wonderful, the friendships that we've made on the Bird app. So when someone picks up this book, Data Conscious, and right off the bat, I noticed that you've broken it down into three major areas, and it's transparency, accountability, and then governance. And you keep governance towards the end, but you start right off the bat about the importance of transparency. And one of the things that I thought was really cool is that you talk about how you got into data as a child. You were thinking about data as a child, working with your dad, managing large amounts of data. What were you doing with your dad?
So my dad, it's so funny you mentioned him because he read that part and was like, oh, I had no idea that made an impact. So my dad was a secretary of this Ames IRS group, and Ames is for the historically underrepresented in the IRS. And he was secretary, and he had to figure out the membership roles every single year. And it was done manually. And that's what I was helping him with, because he would be receiving all of these snail mail of membership roles from all over the country of all the different chapters. And of course, that meant that our home was filled with lots of mail that then needed to be organized. So I was physically organizing and helping him out that way until I got tired. And then he took over everything else. And while he was the secretary of this organization, he wound up doing the digitization of that. So trying to make sure everything was now in a computing system, in a database. And he started that transition, because getting all that mail was a lot. And then reconciling who was on the membership from one year to another, if they moved, right? If they paid their dues once they moved to the new location, if they happened to retire, et cetera, as you can imagine, doing any type of manual role would be quite cumbersome. And so since there were many dozens of chapters that he had to organize, I was, a preteen trying to help him out.
Yeah. And this is really cool, because you refer to this as kind of your awakening in the context of data consciousness. You don't think about preteens managing much more than a couple of friends' phone numbers. But here you are managing the roles of a non-trivially sized organization. Do right. you think data consciousness is something that everyone should have at such a young age?
I think everyone does have it now. I think that because we have these little things on our
little pocket supercomputers, yeah.
I think we all are managing our own data consciousness as we are trying to figure out when to engage with these devices, how often to respond, what to do once we receive the information. Do we respond right away? Do we wait? And what is the form that it's coming to us? If it's coming via text, that's one mode that kind of garners an immediate response, versus if it's coming via email, that might mean that you can take a little while to respond. And then there's all the different apps on these devices that then garner how much attention do you pay to which apps, mm-hmm. right? Are you on certain social media platforms? Are you engaging in certain types of conversation? Are you listening to podcasts, to music of a certain genre or flair? So I think there's a lot of consciousness that we're doing now that I think is unconscious. So I'm hoping that this book brings all of that kind of bubbles up to the top on how we are engaging and how we all are data people.
Yeah. Well, I think it seems like people seem to have forgotten where data comes from. The data is you, right? Like if you are on a Facebook, what is the customer of Facebook? The customer isn't you. The customer is the advertisers, and you are in fact the product. That is a level of consciousness that I hope my kids understand at some point, because how they move through space is data. We hear about things like IoT, Internet of Things, but I need my kids and my parents to understand that the T in IoT is things. That's them. Their motions right. through space and their clicking is all a data stream that someone's going to use for possibly nefarious purposes.
Or at the very minimal, monetization, right? Because our data gets bought and sold all the time.
Right. And then that gets where it gets very squishy, because this data is me, but I don't actually own that. I have granted someone a license to it. So when you click through these long EULAs, these long end user license agreements, you are basically signing over rights to your own data that you have created.
Right. But we don't necessarily sign them over. We're almost coerced into mm-hmm. signing them over. Right. And that's a little thread that I talk about throughout the book, is we don't necessarily have we are not being consensual sometimes in the fact that we're giving up our data, right? Because in order for you to download this particular app or use the service, mm-hmm. you have to click accept. There is no option to say, okay, I opt out.
Right. There's no kick the tires button.
Nope. So we are, forced to engage inside of these digital streets. And so that is another area of data consciousness that I want people to understand, is that, yes, you get the choice to use that product or not, but that's really your only two options. There's no option that's in the middle. And hopefully legislation will get to the place where we can have that third option, where we can opt out of things.
Yeah. One of the things that I like about the book is that you juxtapose a lot of things that I wouldn't have expected to be juxtaposed. You'll bring up the idea of data consciousness, and then you'll juxtapose it with something that kind of surprises me. So for example, mapping technical ethics, tech ethics to human ethics, you point out that we've been studying moral principles for 2,500 years or longer. Like, big thinkers have been thinking about the philosophy, but we've only been thinking about that in the context of data and AI for like 10 years, maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
So there's an immaturity imbalance, right? There's an immaturity imbalance between those kind of things. And then you just made the point about law, which we'll get to a little later in governance, though, but the idea that tech moves incredibly fast and, something like Stable Diffusion or DALL-E comes out yesterday. Like, I learned about Stable Diffusion last month. And then our legislators are saying the internet is a series of tubes. Yeah. How do we reconcile this?
Yeah. I mean, this is, I think, the reason why I wrote the book, and is because this is the gap that I saw. Mm. I saw that technology was moving super fast, but everything else was moving super slow compared to technology. And nobody was having this conversation of how to contextualize technology and all of the data that we are producing and generating every day, all the data and technology we're ingesting every day, and how do we vet all this stuff? So yes, I do just oppose a lot of different aspects, but that is on purpose to bring up this notion that we need to contextualize. Like, we need to understand what's the root, what's the source, understanding what is ownership. We need to ask these fundamental questions. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to morality, it's like, yes, there has been people talking about morality for thousands of years, but no one's really talked about morality inside of the idea of tech. That's only about, you know, let's say it's 40 years old to be generous. But because technology gets refreshed, so to speak, every 18 months, that means that our conversation about morality needs to be updated every 18 months, but it's not.
Yes. And even worse,
it just stays the same.
And you have an entire chapter on morality, but even worse, in your next chapter, you talk about how ethics itself is not instilled as a core tenet for computer science. You take a class. I did the schooling. You did far more schooling. Did you take a lot of ethics and computer science classes during your PhD?
What you talking about? What you talking about, man? No. No, it was just sort of rolled into conversation, right? Mm-hmm. It was just part of the discussion. And it was really positioned as what's the impact of the technology, as though technology was going to be a fix for whatever happens to be the ethical issues. It never was a separate conversation about professional ethics and conduct. It was always about, oh, we're going to create this tech system. We're going to create this data tool in order to do XYZ to help some big societal issue or problem. It never was a conversation about technology itself being a source of harm.
Interesting. Technology as a source of harm. Do you think that technologists are tending to water down problems that we think to ourselves, oh, this isn't a big problem. I can solve that with a little database, or I just need another back-end system, and that'll solve that problem. It seems like we tend to minimize things by saying, just, I can just do this, and we bypass.
I think that there are some that believe that. I think that there are some that truly believe that there is a fix for problems. But I put together an argument that says societal ills, social ills, cannot be solved by technology alone. I put together this argument that humans must be in the loop in order to be the guardrails and provide the goalpost, because technology, as it is structured, only goes in one direction, and that is forward. People are able to go backward and side to side, but technology only goes forward. When you write a program, and you try to then compile it, it will be yes or no to compile it. If it compiles, then you can go ahead and execute. But the execution keeps going until it gets to a place of termination. It does not sit back and wait and think, well, should I be doing this or should I be doing this? It looks at a rule. It looks at an if condition. It looks at a switch statement. It looks at a while loop. It looks at a threshold that you've put in and you've coded in as a programmer, and then it will make a choice, right? But again, it goes back to the people who have programmed said system.
Yeah. And this then gets even worse. You have a section where you discuss something, a term that I hadn't thought about before, code cloning. The idea that in today's society and the way that software developers work now, we don't really sit down with a blank screen. We sit down with a pile of existing software and frameworks and things that we can go and clone and grab, which may themselves have inherent problems, biases, or whatever baked into them. And we don't even think about that because we just grab the framework and run.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So then in doing that, we are making it worse. The snowball is getting bigger as it rolls downhill, right? It's only going forward. I'm not going to not pick a framework or not pick a system because of some ethical problem. I might just do it anyway.
Right. Because if there is a framework already available to you that's already been used by other people, especially if they've been used mm-hmm. by individuals and companies and platforms that are very well known, you as the lowly programmer, as that developer, is not going to try to create it from scratch. It doesn't make time sense. It doesn't make sense for you to do anyway, because people mm-hmm. are going to be like, why'd you start this from scratch?
Right.
So I bring code cloning up as an issue because no one's vetting a lot of this open source
yeah.
code.
Yeah.
There is this notion that because it's open, that it is more ethical, but those ties, I don't see the bridge because no one is doing an ethical review of mm-hmm. the code. Right? They put up the code
yeah.
and they have people use the code and people make sure there's no errors in the code, but those errors are more statistical, not societal.
Hey friends, let's take a moment and thank our sponsors. Basecamp is a project management and team communication application that's been around for around 18 years. It's used by thousands of companies today. It was built with meaning and intentionality, and every feature was designed with purpose, with the thought being to help users simplify their workflow. To keep things simple, and it's harder than it looks. But the team at 37 Signals tries to make these hard decisions so our customers enjoy a tool that's simple and effective, and you use it to collaborate with internal teams and clients. It was built to help teams stay in the loop of the work they need to do without overwhelming everyone with countless emails and notifications. You can go to basecamp.com/Hanselminutes and sign up today to start a free 30-day trial. There's no credit card required, and you can cancel online at any time. If you want to know if Basecamp is right for your team, signing up for a trial is the best way to do so. Remember to go to basecamp.com/Hanselminutes to get your free trial. Thanks, Basecamp, for sponsoring this episode. We're in a very polarized time now, though, politically, and people seem to are getting to picking sides. You know, maybe those sides always existed. Maybe we're fooling ourselves to thinking that we are more polarized now than we were before, but it certainly feels like that. I don't think it's a controversial statement. So then what do you do when someone says, nah, you're bringing politics into tech, you're bringing politics into this? When is it being a human and when is it politics?
I don't see a difference. I mean, I'm a Black woman in tech with a PhD in computer science. Everything I do is about my humanity, mm-hmm. and it's also a political statement, right? So for me, there is no difference. Tech is political. I mean, if we look around at all of the devices and all the technology we use every single day, that didn't happen overnight, right? If you go back in the history, you can pretty much pinpoint somewhere in like the late 80s, there was a decision made somewhere in Silicon Valley that tech was going to be a thing, that the internet was going to revolutionize, and that there was going to be artificial intelligence systems that were going to automate processes. And we have just been the generation living through that decision. And yeah. everything that has come since then has reinforced that decision. And now that we're in the move fast and break things, we're in the break things part. And so now chicken has come home to roost. We're having some difficult conversations that were not had back in, let's say, the late 80s. When the decision was made that there was going to be this artificial intelligence concentration and wave and technology, and everything was going to be about the computing infrastructure that then led to the social media revolution that's leading to whatever the next phase is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The VR, AR conversation. It's all part of the same continuum to me.
That reminds me of one of my favorite quotes, which is, the avalanche has begun. It's too late for the pebbles to vote.
Right.
That's a very sad and uncomfortable statement, though, because...
I haven't heard that one, but I like it.
You like that? You like that?
I like that one,
Babylon
yes.
5, in fact. But you can use that because it really is a very painful and very visceral way of expressing that this thing is happening. But here's the thing, though. Is this book one of hope? It is... It has got, you know, every chapter has footnotes. There is 20 books that I should read after this book to understand the ramifications of it, right? There is this one of like, here's the documentation of why we're screwed, or is this a, and here's what we can do to make it better, hopeful?
I think this is a hopeful book because it lays bare of the all the things that have been unsaid. So my hope is that through the book, there will be people who will, let's say, take a chapter and create their own book. Because I think that is part of the conversation, is that we can't keep, as a technological society, only talk about the tech side or only talk about the data side. We need to talk about the political, the historical, the legal, the civic, right? We need to talk about all of it. And I'm one person. Mm-hmm. Providing just, hey, here's the things. Let's now call the things what they are. So this is what happens in science. You got to name the problem before you can solve the problem. So this book is naming the problems. Like, here we go. Here are the problems. Let's make it clear so no one can be confused. And then other people can take that baton and create other books, other series of hopes, take the notes and the suggestions and the recommendations that I provide and say, hey, this worked. This didn't work as good as I wanted. It only worked in this particular area, or this didn't work at all, or this really, really worked, this suggestion. That is the part of the conversation in order to move us to a better society. But until we come face to face that things are broken, we're not going to be able to move forward. And we're always going to be part of this continuum thinking, just make a tech product. Don't care about the data. It's going to be an issue. So let's not have that particular hamster wheel keep going. Let's stop the hamster wheel and let's move forward.
Yeah. One of the things that you called out in your section on accountability is decisions in a vacuum, like acknowledging that a lot of the decisions around how we store data, how we think about data, what we call data stewardship, are happening in boardrooms with a CIO and a CTO and not the people that will be affected by that thing downstream. To your point about whether it happened in the 80s or whether it's happening right now in some startup, data stewardship seems to be ignored.
Yes. I believe so. I think data stewardship is the glue that holds a lot of principles together inside of AI systems, and it's completely ignored. So a lot of companies that I've engaged with have CTOs and CIOs, but don't have CDOs, or, you know, chief data officers. And they don't really understand the difference between a CIO, a CTO, and a CDO. and it's very apparent because their data policies for their, you know, customers and their stakeholders are not applied internally inside the organizations. And this is why you will see a lot of disruption inside of companies once a CDO comes into play, because no one's talking about the data inside the company. Everyone's so concerned about what the customers think, what the stakeholders think. So I think data stewardship is one of those concentrations that have been kind of left by the wayside. But I have to make a disclaimer here. Database is my tech jam. So I love organizing data, modeling data, telling people, hey, these data don't work together, they're apples and oranges. So I'm coming definitely from my perspective of being a database information retrieval researcher and scholar.
Right. Yeah. Your focus, and I've got 48 tabs open as I research all of these shows, you know, is in data education, equity practice, talent development. You want people to respect data more so that they will be better people and better engineers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Precisely. Now,
so to that point, one of the things that I thought was going to be amazing and was going to solve a lot of these data problems was going to be great visualizations. I thought that like D3JS and like the New York Times has a whole team of visualizers.
Right.
And then when Twitter gets a hold of a good data visualization, there's always like, you know, hashtag dat y-axis or whatever, because it's always a lie. The whatever it is, the y-axis is wrong. We can pretty much count on that. You have an entire chapter dedicated to the how visualizations lure us in, and then they screw us.
Yes, I do. And this was not the intent of the chapter. The chapter's intent was what you said, is to show the value of visualizations and how they can be used in order to help narrate the data story so well. Mm. And then as I did the research, as you've read inside the book, I was like, oh, well, maybe this isn't the chapter that I thought it was going to be. It became a more of a referendum of what is being shared visually and how do we vet that? Because there are times in which there's misinformation and disinformation campaigns that use visuals for nefarious purposes. So we need to be, again, data conscious about what we are putting out there into the world. And that's for all the people who are just creating reports and creating graphs and figures and just thinking, we don't care about what N is. No, yes, we do. We don't care about if this bar chart really is representative as far as magnitude. Yes, we do, in scale. Like, we care about these things.
Yeah. And you call out that critiquing visuals is going to require not just a strong backbone as a human, but also a strong understanding of the technology, of the ethics, of the societal issues behind it, because you could indirectly sell the wrong thing. And by sell the wrong thing, sell the wrong concept, sell the wrong idea by just being sloppy in your data visualizations and not know that that visualization is more harmful than, yeah, than good.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And it could be inaccurate. You just don't know.
Yeah.
So it's good to know the source of it.
So as we move towards the latter third of the book, you get into governance. Now, I thought it was interesting that governance was part three, because I wasn't sure if you were trying to express that governance was the solution or simply a solution, because it is the final third of the book.
It to me is really part of a solution. That's the reason why there's three chapters and I didn't do a fourth chapter. All the rest, the other two sections had four chapters and governance only had three. So the first chapter is really what you would expect. Here is what the laws are. This is kind of the state of AI governance, so to speak, and where the ethics kind of fall and how the law has been used as the, you know, final goalpost, so to speak, in making sure that we are responsible and accountable and transparent when it comes to the technology. But then I move on to really a call to action by the last chapter to say, hey, everybody, guess who is in charge of governance? And that is all of us. That if we as individuals put pressure on our systems, be them political or economic or civic or social, this is a way that we can galvanize and mobilize in order to ensure that we have the governance in the laws that we seek, but the law is limited because it is so slow.
Yeah. And I like that you call it data civics. I mean, we know about civics. We learn some civics in school, and that might be, you know, hyper local in our, you know, villages and towns, or it might be larger with our state and our federal representatives. But you call out that becoming a data conscious person is maybe something that didn't exist before 2000. You actually start that saying that a tiny, tiny percentage of the global population really understood data and algorithms. And now we hear people talking about algorithms in coffee shops and sandwich shops, like regular, you know, mom and pop type folks. They care about this stuff. So then everyone should have an understanding of data civics, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. I think data is the universal currency, right? And so I think having a data civics understanding is important to be a good citizen of the world. We need to understand, not all of us need to know how to code. I never say that, but I think it's important that you understand how data flows through systems. And you can understand that at an abstract level, whether you say algorithms or you don't. You need to understand how your information is perpetuating through all of these digital infrastructures. And what does that mean to you? How does that affect you and your family? Not just the scary data privacy issues, but also how do you know that your bill is getting paid by clicking that button?
That's a really great point. And you call that out. You actually propose some data civic stages about your relationship with data, your relationship with data inequity, and then your relationship to machines. You're not saying that everyone needs to be a data programmer. I don't need to learn SQL, SQL. I can just understand how it affects my family and my community. And that's a start, because that's better than nothing at this point for data civics.
Yes. And I think that is the difference that I think I bring in the book, is that I'm not talking about data science. I'm talking about data for the people. And data for the people means, how does it start with you? And then from you outward to your family, to your workplace, and then of course to the larger bits of society, right? Because I think it's necessary that we reposition how we are thinking about data civics and how we engage with data, because data is too scary for people. So we can call it content civics if you want. We can call it insights, whatever term tends to be, you know, make it easier to understand, but just to know that data is more than numbers.
I think the best term is the term that you titled the book, that the book is data conscience. We'll put a link in the show notes. Folks can check out Dr. Marshall's book. I really appreciate you hanging out with me today.
Thank you so much. This has been fun. And the questions weren't tough. These were easy.
I will try to bring more hardball questions next time.
Please do. Thank you so much, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.